This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Okay, so you're back again, and you're ready for more deep dives.
Always ready.
All right, well, this time we're tackling kidney and urinary disorders.
Ah, the nitty-gritty of what keeps us going.
Right. I mean, these systems are so essential, but we don't always think about them until something goes wrong.
That's the human condition, I suppose.
So we've got a bunch of your sources here.
Excellent.
And the mission is basically to figure out, like, what are the biggest things that can go haywire with these systems?
Love it. Let's unravel the mysteries of the kidneys and bladder.
All right. Well, the first thing that jumps out at me from the stuff you sent over is this term, acute kidney injury.
AKI.
AKI. Okay.
Yeah.
What exactly is happening there when someone has AKI?
Well, essentially, it's when your kidneys suddenly decide to take a vacation. They just stop doing their job properly.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's not good. The main thing is they lose their ability to filter waste products from the blood effectively.
So like all that stuff that's supposed to be getting fleshed out just starts building up?
Exactly. And doctors can tell this is happening because you'll see a big jump in something called serum creatinine.
Creatinine?
Yeah, it's a waste product that your kidneys normally filter out. So when the kidneys aren't working right, creatinine levels in your blood shoot up. That's one of the big red flags for AKI.
So, like, how much of an increase are we talking here?
Usually they're looking for an increase of 50% or more above your baseline level.
Above your baseline. Okay. So it's like a sudden spike, not a gradual thing.
Right. It's like hitting a wall, not a slow decline.
So what kind of things can actually cause this sudden kidney shutdown?
Well, there are a few main categories.
Okay.
The first is what they call pre-renal causes. And this basically means there's a problem with the blood flow to the kidneys. Think of it this way. Your kidneys are like a factory.
Yep.
They need a constant supply of raw materials to do their work. And in this case, the raw material is blood.
Makes sense.
So if the kidneys aren't getting enough blood, they can't function properly.
So what could cause that lack of blood flow?
Oh, a bunch of things. Severe dehydration is a big one. When your body is really low on fluids, your blood volume drops, and that means less blood reaching the kidneys. It's called hypovolemia.
Hypovolemia, so low blood volume.
Got it. Then you have things like really low blood pressure or hypotension. You know, if your blood pressure plummets, there's just not enough force to push the blood through the kidneys effectively.
I see.
And then any problems with the heart, like a weak heart that's not pumping well, can also reduce blood flow to the kidneys. They call that reduced cardiac output or heart failure.
Heart failure. Wow. So even something that seems totally unrelated to the kidneys, like dehydration, can end up messing with them.
Absolutely. The kidneys are really sensitive to changes in blood flow. They're kind of on the front lines of maintaining the balance in your whole circulatory system.
It's like a domino effect.
Exactly. One thing leads to another.
Makes you realize how interconnected everything is.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Okay. So that's pre-renal causes. Yeah. What about that second category you mentioned, intrarenal?
Yeah, intrarenal, that means the problem is within the kidney tissue itself. Some kind of damage to the actual structure of the kidney.
So like an injury to the kidney itself.
Exactly. Unfortunately, yeah. The sources you provided don't get into the specifics of what could cause that direct damage.
Okay, so it's kind of a broad category for now.
Got it. But it's important to know that damage to the kidneys themselves can definitely lead to AKI.
Right. So then we've got one more category, postrenal.
Right. Postrenal AKI is all about blockage. Basically, something's obstructing the flow of urine out of the kidneys.
Like a clogged pipe?
Exactly. Imagine a traffic jam in your urinary system.
Oh, no.
Yeah, not a fun situation. This blockage could happen in a few different places. It could be within the kidney itself, like a kidney stone that's blocking things up.
Okay.
Or it could be further down the line in the lower urinary tract, like in the bladder or the urethra, the tube that carries urine out.
Nice.
And what's really interesting is even a blockage in the renal arteries or veins, the main blood vessels that supply and drain the kidneys, can cause this type of injury.
Really? I would have thought about that. So it's not just about what's happening inside the urinary tract, but also the blood flow in and out of the kidneys?
Right. It's all connected.
Okay. So we've got these three main categories of causes, and then the sources also talk about these phases of AKI. So it sounds like it's not just a one-time event, but it kind of unfolds in stages.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. There are generally four phases that doctors recognize.
Okay.
It starts with the initiation phase, which is when the initial insult or injury to the kidney happens. You know, whatever triggered the AKI in the first place.
Okay, so that's like the inciting incident.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then for many patients, they move into the oliguria phase. And oliguria means a significant decrease in urine output.
So they're not peeing as much.
Right. Their body's trying to hold on to fluid because the kidneys aren't filtering it properly.
Makes sense.
Then after that comes the diuresis phase. And this is where things get a little counterintuitive, because in this phase, urine output actually increases.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily mean the kidneys are all better. It's more like they're starting to wake up again, but they're still a bit wonky.
So it's not like a clear sign of recovery.
Right. It's more like a step in the process.
Okay.
And finally, you have the recovery phase, where kidney function gradually returns to its baseline, or as close to it as possible.
So hopefully they bounce back.
That's the goal. And in many cases, they do. But understanding these phases is really helpful for doctors, because it gives them a roadmap for what to expect and how to manage the patient's care.
Yeah, it's like knowing the typical course of the illness helps them anticipate what might happen next.
Exactly. It's all about staying one step ahead.
So how do doctors actually figure out if someone has AKI? Hmm. I mean, what are they looking for when they're assessing a patient?
Well, one of the first things they'll notice is a drop in urine output if the patient is in the oliguric phase.
Right. So if they're not peeing as much, that's a clue.
Exactly. And they'll also look for things like blood in the urine hematuria.
Blood in the urine? Yikes. That sounds serious.
It can be a sign that something's not right with the kidneys.
Okay.
They'll also check the concentration of the urine, which is measured by its specific gravity.
Specific gravity?
Yeah. It basically tells you how much stuff is dissolved in the urine. And with AKI, the kidneys often lose their ability to concentrate urine properly. So the specific gravity might be all over the place.
I see.
And of course, they'll use imaging tests like ultrasound and CT scans to get a good look at the kidneys themselves.
So those scans can show them if there's any blockage or structural damage.
Exactly. They're essential for getting a clear picture of what's going on.
And what about blood tests? Are those helpful in diagnosing AKI?
Oh, absolutely. Blood tests are crucial. There are a few key things they look for.
Okay.
First, they'll check the levels of BUN and creatinine. Those are waste products that healthy kidneys filter out. So if those levels are high in the blood, it's a pretty clear sign that the kidneys aren't doing their job.
So high BUN and creatinine, bad news for the kidneys.
Pretty much. And then they'll also check electrolyte levels, because AKI can really throw those out of whack.
Electrolytes, right? Those are like the minerals that help your body function properly.
Exactly. And they're really important for things like nerve impulses, muscle contractions, and fluid balance.
So what kind of electrolyte imbalances do you see with AKI?
Well, you often see high potassium, low sodium, low calcium, and high phosphate.
So it's like everything's off kilter.
Yeah, it can get pretty messy. And that high potassium is especially worrisome because it can affect the heart's rhythm.
Oh, that sounds dangerous.
It can be if it's not addressed.
Okay.
Another important measure is the glomerular filtration rate, or GFR. You can think of GFR as a measure of how efficiently your kidneys are filtering waste out of your blood.
So a higher GFR is better.
Yes. A higher GFR means your kidneys are working well. But with AKI, the GFR drops because the filtering mechanism is compromised.
It's like the filters are getting clogged up.
Exactly. And then on top of all that, you can also have metabolic acidosis, which is an imbalance in the body's pH level.
Acidosis, so it's getting too acidic.
Right. And that can cause all sorts of problems if it's not corrected.
Okay, so we've got BUN, creatinine, electrolytes, GFR, and acidosis.
Yeah, those are some of the big ones. And then they might also do a complete blood count, or CBC, which can show things like low red blood cells.
Why would red blood cells be low?
Well, damaged kidneys often produce less erythropoietin, which is a hormone that stimulates red blood cell production.
So it's like a knock-on effect from the kidney damage.
Exactly. And the CBC might also show a high white blood cell count if there's an infection involved.
Infection makes sense. So it's really a whole bunch of different signs, both from the physical exam and the lab tests, that point to AKI.
It's like putting together a puzzle, all the pieces have to fit.
Now, the sources also use this term kidney failure, which I guess is kind of a scarier term.
It does sound more dramatic, doesn't it?
Yeah. So is AKI the same thing as kidney failure?
Well, kidney failure is the more general term. It's used when the kidneys are just not doing their job anymore. They can't filter waste effectively, and they can't maintain the body's internal balance.
So it's like a broader category.
Yeah, exactly. And it becomes a systemic problem, meaning it affects the whole body, not just the kidneys.
Makes sense.
Now, AKI is one type of kidney failure. It's characterized by that rapid decline in kidney function and often by low urine output. But the important thing about AKI is that it's often reversible if you catch it early and treat the underlying cause.
So there's hope.
Absolutely.
But what about the other type of kidney failure? You mentioned chronic kidney disease.
Yeah, chronic renal disease, or end-stage renal disease, ESRD, that's a different beast. That's a long-term progressive and irreversible deterioration of kidney function.
So no coming back from that?
Not really. It's a gradual decline over time. And in ESRD, you see this buildup of waste products in the blood, a condition called azotemia.
Azotemia. So that's like the opposite of what the kidneys are supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Instead of filtering out the waste, it's accumulating.
Got it. So AKI is like a sudden crisis that might be fixable, while chronic kidney disease is a slow burn that leads to permanent damage.
That's a good way to think about it.
Okay. Now, the sources also mention these collaborative problems that can happen alongside kidney disorders.
Yeah, that's a fancy way of saying other issues that pop up, because the kidneys are so intertwined with everything else in the body.
So it's like the kidneys are the keystone, and if they fall out of place, everything else starts to crumble.
Exactly. Because the kidneys play such a vital role in regulating things like electrolytes and blood pressure, when they go haywire, it can trigger a cascade of other problems.
So what kind of problems are we talking about here?
Well, one of the big ones is hyperkalemia, which is just a fancy term for high potassium levels.
High potassium, we talked about that earlier.
Right. And it's really dangerous because it can disrupt the heart's rhythm.
Oh, right. That's why they monitor it so closely.
Exactly. And then you can also have problems with the sacs surrounding the heart, the pericardium.
Okay.
You can get inflammation of the pericardium, which is called pericarditis, and you can get fluid building up around the heart, which is called pericardial effusion.
Pericardial effusion.
And in severe cases, that fluid buildup can put so much pressure on the heart that it can't pump effectively. That's called pericardial tamponade.
Tamponade. That sounds serious.
It is. It's a medical emergency.
Okay, so heart problems are a big concern.
And then, of course, high blood pressure or hypertension is very common with kidney disease.
That makes sense, because the kidneys are involved in regulating blood pressure.
Right. They produce hormones that help control blood pressure. So when the kidneys aren't working properly, blood pressure can go up.
Okay.
And then you have things like anemia, which is a low red blood cell count.
We talked about that before too, right?
Exactly. And that's often because the damaged kidneys aren't producing enough erythropoietin.
Right. The hormone that stimulates red blood cell production.
Exactly. And then you can also have bone disease, because the kidneys play a role in calcium and phosphorus balance.
So it's like the bones get weaker.
Yeah, they can become brittle and more prone to fractures.
And to top it all off, there's even this thing called metastatic calcifications.
Yeah, that's where calcium starts to deposit in soft tissues throughout the body.
Like in your muscles and organs.
Yeah, it can happen anywhere.
So basically, kidney problems can affect almost every system in the body.
It's pretty crazy when you think about it. It really highlights how central the kidneys are to overall health.
So how do doctors approach the medical management of AKI with all these potential complications?
Well, the first and most important step is to identify and treat the underlying cause of the AKI.
So figure out what triggered it in the first place.
Exactly. You got to address the root of the problem.
Makes sense.
And then another key focus is on managing the patient's fluid balance.
So making sure they're not getting too dehydrated, but also not overloading them with fluids.
Exactly. It's a delicate balancing act, because on the one hand, you don't want them to get dehydrated.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you give them too much fluid, it can put a strain on their heart and lungs, which is especially risky if their kidneys aren't functioning properly. And in some cases, they might need renal replacement therapy to temporarily take over the kidney's filtering function.
Like dialysis.
Exactly. Dialysis can be a lifesaver in these situations.
Okay, so the treatment really depends on what caused the AKI in the first place.
Absolutely. So for pre-renal AKI, the focus is on restoring adequate blood flow to the kidneys.
So that might involve giving them fluids if they're dehydrated or medications to raise their blood pressure.
Exactly. And for intrarenal AKI, the treatment depends on what's causing the damage to the kidney tissue.
So if it's something that can be treated like an infection, they'll address that directly.
Right. And if it's something like an autoimmune disorder, they'll focus on managing that condition.
Okay.
And then for postrenal AKI, the main thing is to remove the obstruction that's blocking the flow of urine.
So if it's a kidney stone, they might need to do surgery to get it out.
Exactly. Or they might use other techniques to break up the stone so it can pass more easily.
Okay, so it's really a tailored approach depending on the specific situation.
It has to be. You can't just have a one-size-fits-all treatment for AKI.
Now, what about the role of nurses
Yeah.
in all of this? What kind of hands-on care do EKI patients need?
No, nurses are absolutely essential in managing AKI. Their role is so important.
So what are some of the key things they do?
Well, one of the most crucial things is monitoring the patient's fluid status very closely.
So making sure they're not retaining too much fluid or.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
They're getting dehydrated.
Exactly. It's all about finding that sweet spot.
Okay.
So they'll be looking for any signs of fluid excess, like swelling in the legs or shortness of breath.
Edema and shortness of breath. Got it.
And they'll be keeping track of the patient's intake and output very carefully, measuring everything that goes in and everything that comes out.
So like how much they're drinking and how much they're peeing.
Exactly. And they'll also be weighing the patient every day because weight is often the most accurate indicator of fluid gain or loss.
So if they're suddenly gaining weight, that could be a sign of fluid retention.
Exactly. It's like a built-in warning system. And if the patient needs to be on fluid restrictions, the nurses play a big role in explaining why that's necessary and helping the patient cope with it.
Because that can't be easy.
No, it's not. It's hard to be thirsty all the time. So the nurses are there to provide support and encouragement.
And they'll also be making sure the patient is getting enough fluids from other sources like IV fluids or medications.
Right, they have to account for every drop.
And what about oral hygiene?
That's important too, because if your mouth is dry, it can make you feel even thirstier. So the nurses will help the patient with mouth care to keep things comfortable.
So it's really a holistic approach to managing fluid balance.
It has to be. You can't just focus on one aspect.
And what about nutrition? What are the dietary considerations for AKI patients?
Well, nutrition is tricky because you have to balance providing adequate calories and nutrients with the fact that the kidneys aren't working properly.
Right, so they might need to restrict certain things.
Exactly. They often have to limit things like sodium, potassium, and phosphorus because those can build up in the blood when the kidneys aren't filtering them out.
Makes sense.
So the nurses work closely with dietitians to come up with a meal plan that meets the patient's needs.
So it's like a customized diet plan.
Exactly. And they try to take the patient's preferences into account as much as possible.
Because no one wants to eat hospital food forever.
No, definitely not. So they encourage patients to eat high-quality, nutritious foods within their restrictions.
And what if the patient has other issues like mouth sores or loss of appetite?
Well, then they might need to adjust the diet further to make it easier to eat.
So like pureed foods or smaller, more frequent meals.
Exactly. It's all about finding ways to make sure the patient is getting the nutrition they need, even when they're not feeling their best.
So it's really a team effort between the nurses, the dietitians, and the patient.
Absolutely. It takes everyone working together.
And what about the emotional side of things? Because dealing with a serious illness like AKI can be really tough.
Oh, absolutely. It can be a very scary and overwhelming experience.
So what kind of support do nurses provide in that area?
Well, they provide a lot of emotional support and education. They assess how the patient and their family are coping with the diagnosis and treatment.
So, like, are they anxious? Are they depressed? Are they feeling overwhelmed?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They want to understand what the patient is going through and how they can best support them.
And they'll also help the patient and their family understand what to expect during the course of treatment.
Right. They'll explain the different procedures and medications and answer any questions they might have.
So it's like they're providing a roadmap for the journey.
Exactly. And they also create a space for the patient and their family to talk about their fears and concerns.
Because sometimes just having someone to listen can make a huge difference.
It really can.
Yeah.
It's all about being present and empathetic.
Now, earlier we talked about renal replacement therapy, which is basically taking over the job of the kidneys when they're not working.
Right, like dialysis.
Exactly. So can you explain a bit more about how dialysis works?
Sure. So there are two main types of dialysis: hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis.
Okay.
Hemodialysis is the one most people are familiar with. It's what you see in movies and TV shows.
With the big machines and the tubes.
Exactly. In hemodialysis, the patient's blood is circulated outside their body through a machine called a dialyzer.
And the dialyzer filters out the waste products and extra fluid.
Right. It acts like an artificial kidney.
So how do they get the blood out of the body and into the machine?
They need a special access point to the bloodstream. Usually it's an arteriovenous fistula, which is a surgical connection between an artery and a vein in the arm.
So they basically create a shortcut between the artery and vein.
Exactly. And that makes the vein bigger and stronger so they can insert needles for dialysis.
Okay.
Sometimes they use an arteriovenous graft instead, which is a synthetic tube that connects an artery and a vein.
So it's like an artificial blood vessel.
Exactly.
And once the blood is in the dialyzer, how does it get cleaned?
Well, there are a few different processes involved. One is diffusion, which is just the movement of substances from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration.
So the waste products move from the blood where they're concentrated into the dialysis fluid where they're not.
Exactly. And then there's osmosis, which is the movement of water across a semi-permeable membrane.
So in this case, water moves from the blood, which has more water, into the dialysis fluid, which has less water.
Right. And that helps remove excess fluid from the body.
And then there's ultrafiltration, which is basically using pressure to push fluid out of the blood.
Exactly. So it's like squeezing out the extra water.
Okay, so it's a combination of these different processes that cleans the blood.
Right. And then the clean blood is returned to the body.
Amazing. So that's hemodialysis.
Yeah.
What about peritoneal dialysis?
So peritoneal dialysis is a bit different. It still aims to remove waste products and excess fluid, but it uses the lining of your abdomen, the peritoneal membrane, as the filter.
Oh, wow. So they don't need a machine.
Not in the same way. They do need a catheter, which is a thin tube that's surgically inserted into the abdomen.
All right.
And then they infuse a special sterile solution called dialysate into the peritoneal cavity, which is the space between the abdominal wall and the organs.
Well, the dialysate fills up the abdomen.
Right. And because the peritoneal membrane is semi-permeable, it allows waste products and excess fluid to pass from the blood into the dialysate.
So it's like the dialysate sucks out the bad stuff.
Exactly. And then after a certain dwell time, they drain out the used dialysate and replace it with fresh solution.
Interesting. So is it a continuous process?
It can be. There's a type of peritoneal dialysis called continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis, or CAPD, where the patient manually exchanges the fluid several times a day.
So they do it themselves at home.
Exactly. And then there's continuous cyclic peritoneal dialysis, or CCPD, which uses a machine to do the exchanges automatically, usually overnight, while the patient sleeps.
So it's like having a little dialysis buddy at home.
That's a good way to put it.
But are there any risks with peritoneal dialysis?
Well, like any medical procedure, there are potential complications.
Okay.
One of the most serious is peritonitis, which is an infection of the peritoneum.
Infection, that doesn't sound good.
No, it's not. It can be very serious. So they take a lot of precautions to prevent it.
Okay.
You can also have leakage of the dialysis fluid around the catheter.
So it's like a leaky faucet.
Sort of. And then there's always a risk of bleeding anytime you're inserting a catheter.
Right. So it's not without its risks.
No. But for many people, it's a good alternative to hemodialysis.
Okay. So we've got these two main types of dialysis.
Yeah.
What are some of the key things that nurses need to monitor when a patient is on dialysis?
Well, it depends on the type of dialysis, but there are some general things to watch for.
Okay.
For patients on hemodialysis, one of the most important things is to make sure the vascular access site is working properly and not infected.
Right, because that's their lifeline to the dialysis machine.
Exactly. So the nurses will regularly check for a thrill and a bruit over the fistula or graft.
A thrill and a bruit. What are those?
A thrill is a vibration you can feel with your fingers, and a bruit is a whooshing sound you can hear with a stethoscope. They both indicate good blood flow through the access site.
Okay, so if you can feel it and hear it, that's a good sign.
Exactly. And they'll also be looking for any signs of infection, like redness, swelling, or drainage.
Right, because infection can be a big problem with any kind of catheter or access site.
Absolutely. And it's really important that they don't take blood pressure or draw blood from the arm with the vascular access,
Why is that?
because it can damage the fistula or graft and make it harder to do dialysis.
Got it. So they have to protect that arm like it's gold.
Pretty much.
Okay, so that's the vascular access.
Yeah.
What else do they monitor?
Well, fluid balance is huge. They'll be tracking the patient's intake and output very closely.
So that includes any IV fluids they're getting.
Absolutely. Everything has to be accounted for.
And they'll be checking their weight regularly too, right?
Yeah, because weight changes can be a good indicator of fluid gain or loss. And then they'll also be monitoring for signs and symptoms of uremia, which is the buildup of waste products in the blood.
Because that's what dialysis is supposed to be preventing.
Right. So if the patient starts showing signs of uremia, it means the dialysis isn't working well enough.
And what kind of signs are we talking about?
Oh, it can be a lot of things. Fatigue, nausea, vomiting, confusion, itching, muscle cramps.
So it can affect the whole body.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
Okay.
They'll also be keeping a close eye on the patient's electrolyte levels because those can fluctuate a lot with dialysis.
Right, because the dialysis is removing some electrolytes from the blood.
Exactly. So they have to monitor those levels and adjust the dialysis prescription accordingly.
Okay, so it's a constant balancing
It
act.
really is.
And what about the patient's heart and lungs?
Yeah, those are important to monitor too because dialysis can put a strain on the cardiovascular system.
So they'll be checking their blood pressure, heart rate, and breathing.
Exactly. And they might need to adjust the patient's medications before dialysis.
Oh, right, because some medications can interfere with the dialysis process.
Exactly. So they have to be very careful about medication management.
So it's a lot of responsibility.
It is, but nurses are trained to handle it. They're amazing at multitasking and keeping track of all the details.
So beyond all that monitoring, what other nursing care do dialysis patients need?
Well, medication management is a big one.
Right, because kidney disease can affect how your body processes medications.
Exactly. So they have to be very careful about adjusting doses and timing.
Okay.
And then pain management is important too, because dialysis can be uncomfortable.
So they might need pain meds during or after the treatment.
Exactly. And they'll also be doing a lot of patient education.
About their diet and medications and how to care for their access site.
Right. And how to recognize the signs and symptoms of complications.
Because it's really important for patients to be involved in their own care.
Absolutely. They need to be empowered to take charge of their health.
Now, what about infection control? Is that a big concern with dialysis?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. Because dialysis patients often have weakened immune systems, they're more susceptible to infections.
So they have to be extra careful.
Exactly. So the nurses will be following strict infection control protocols.
Like washing their hands frequently and wearing gloves and gowns.
Exactly. And they'll be teaching the patients how to keep their access site clean and dry.
And what about diet for dialysis patients? Are there special considerations there?
Yeah, because dialysis affects the balance of fluids and electrolytes, they often have to follow a pretty restricted diet.
So they might have to limit things like sodium, potassium, and phosphorus.
Exactly. And they might also need to limit protein depending on their kidney function.
So it's not exactly a gourmet meal plan.
No, but there are ways to make it tasty and enjoyable.
And the nurses will work with the dietitians to come up with a plan that meets the patient's individual needs.
Right. It's all about finding a balance between what's healthy and what's doable.
Okay. And what about skin care? Is that important for dialysis patients?
Yeah, because dialysis can really dry out the skin.
So they might need to use special lotions or creams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they have to be careful about scratching because that can lead to infections.
So the nurses will be teaching them good skincare techniques.
Absolutely. It's an important part of their overall care.
Now, the sources also mentioned kidney transplantation as a treatment option.
Yeah, that's kind of the gold standard for treating end-stage renal disease.
So what happens after someone gets a kidney transplant?
Well, it's a major surgery, so they'll be in the hospital for a few days afterwards.
And the nurses will be monitoring them very closely.
Oh, yeah, they'll be checking their vital signs, their urine output, their pain levels.
Making sure the new kidney is working properly.
Exactly. And they'll be watching for any signs of complications.
Like rejection of the new kidney.
Right. Or infection or bleeding.
So it's a critical time.
It is. But with good nursing care, most transplant patients do very well.
That's good to hear. So what kind of patient education is important for people with kidney disorders?
Oh, there's a lot to cover. They need to understand their condition, how to manage it at home, how to recognize signs of complications, who to call if they have problems.
So it's like empowering them to be their own advocates.
Exactly. And it's important to involve their family in the education too.
Because they're the ones who are going to be providing support at home.
Exactly. It takes a village.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with kidney disorders. Now let's shift gears and talk about urinary tract infections, or UTIs.
Those are always fun.
Right, because everyone loves a good UTI.
Ah-ha-ha, very funny. But seriously, UTIs are one of the most common reasons people seek medical care.
Yeah, I've had my fair share of them.
And they can be really annoying and painful.
Definitely. Yeah. So can you give us a quick overview of what UTIs are and what causes them?
Sure. So a UTI is basically an infection that occurs anywhere along the urinary tract.
Which includes the kidneys, the ureters, the bladder, and the urethra.
Exactly. Mm. And most UTIs are caused by bacteria that enter the urethra and travel up to the bladder.
And women are more prone to them than men.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's because women have a shorter urethra, so it's easier for bacteria to reach the bladder.
Makes sense.
But men can get UTIs, too.
Okay. So what are some of the risk factors for developing a UTI?
Well, anything that interferes with the normal flow of urine can increase your risk.
Like a blockage in the urinary tract.
Exactly. Or certain medical conditions like diabetes.
Okay.
And then certain behaviors can increase your risk too, like using a diaphragm for birth control or having frequent sexual intercourse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because those activities can introduce bacteria into the urethra.
I see.
And wiping from back to front after going to the bathroom can also increase your risk.
So it's like pushing bacteria towards the urethra instead of away from it.
Exactly. So it's important to wipe from front to back.
Got it.
And then holding your pee for too long can also increase your risk because it gives bacteria more time to multiply in the bladder.
So go when you gotta go.
Exactly. Don't hold it in.
Okay. So the sources also make a distinction between lower UTIs and upper UTIs. What's the difference?
So a lower UTI is an infection.